I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We're joined again by Tito Perdue and his wife, Judy, and we're going to be continuing to discuss Tito's literary career and life. And we left off last time with his book, The New Austerities. So, Tito, after The New Austerities appeared, what was next in your literary agenda?
The next book, I think, was The Node. My book, The Node, which was published by Chip Smith of nine banded books,
right.
small publisher. He did a very good job, I thought, and the cover was done by Alex Kurdajic, whom I prefer for my covers. He's done several of them. And The Node is the dystopian novel about the near future, describing a small group of people who are trying to survive in a dystopian future in which Caucasian peoples have been driven into the corners of the country and who are trying to not only maintain but to repopulate certain areas of the country with people that share our Western ideals and Caucasian habits and Caucasian culture, and who go through a great many adventures before they finally find a place to settle. That's the theme of the book. And it was fun to write that book, I must say. The more the older I get, the more non-real, the more unrealistic my books get. And this book is very unrealistic. And I've been criticized for that by people who expect books to be plausible. Well, there's nothing plausible about this book. So it was fun to write, and it established a few precedents that I have followed since then in my other books. For example, I imagine that this is a period in which technology has created a new sort of instrument called an escrubulator, which is an omnicompetent sort of mechanism that is able to dissolve molecular bands at great distances. And it also is a semi-biological creature that reproduces and is able to make the sun go down whenever the owner wants it to go down. In other words, a little machine that can do anything the possessor wants it to do.
So this is the first novel of yours that has science fiction elements in it?
I think so, yeah. Of course, it's not real science. I'm not a scientist, but I like to play with the ideas that science has brought forth. For example, de-evolution.
Right. There's a lot of that going on. That's not science fiction. So let's talk then about how you came to the political views and the views about race that are reflected in The Node. Because when you last mentioned politics, which was in our last segment, you talked about how when you went off to college, you wanted to go to Antioch College because it was the most left-wing college you could find. You've obviously changed a bit since
then.
Changed
greatly.
So tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the pre-integration South, and I saw that black people really were not treated properly at all, that they lived a life of daily humiliation. And I was reacting against that, which was one reason I wanted to go up north to go to school, one reason I wanted to go to Antioch. And I kept that liberal attitude toward race for many years. But then I began to realize that once black people had been given all the advantages they had asked for, which is legal equality, not only legal equality, but extra legal advantages, such as affirmative action, affirmative hiring, aid to dependent children, welfare of all kinds, that instead of using these benefits to elevate themselves, they used it in exactly the opposite way, which is to indulge themselves. They became the premier users of illegal drugs, not to mention the extraordinary production of illegitimate children, crime, murder, inability to finish high school. I began to change my attitude toward this race of people. You know, why can someone from Southeast Asia come over not even able to speak the language, and that person's children is becomes a top graduate of their high school and go on to Yale University, having not been here more than 20 years? How come they can adopt? How come the Japanese can come, the Vietnamese can come, and can succeed better than our native white people? And black people who've been here 300 years can't learn to read. Something's wrong. There is something wrong between the measurements of these two races, between the Caucasian races and the African races. Something genetic. It is a genetic problem. It is not just a cultural problem. Not just a question of being able to adapt to a new culture. It is the desire not to adapt. A preference for pleasure over postponing pleasure. A preference for unrestrained behavior. This is not what I had expected from black people when they were struggling for equal rights. So I've become very disappointed in their behavior. And, Hispanics who come here not knowing the language, coming from a region of poverty, they generally, over time, become civilized people, able to contribute to society. I really wonder whether if you were to measure up all the benefits and disadvantages that have been given to us by black people, whether it might not end up as a negative sum. So I'm become very depressed about the future of black people in this country. I notice, too, that in those countries where black people predominate, particularly the sub-Saharan areas or in Haiti, that the general cultural and civilizational level is very, very bad. They cannot blame that on slavery. They cannot blame that on oppression. Most of those countries have been free, black-ruled, for decades. And yet, instead of getting better, they just get worse. Look at Rwanda, for example. If you want to talk about oppression, look at what black people have done to black people. If you want to talk about crime, look at the crime rate in this country, where a white person is 20 times more likely to be killed by a black person than the other way around. Something's wrong. Something is genetically mistaken. And I know that's not something you're supposed to be allowed to say. You can actually lose your job for saying something like that. But there's something genetic going on here. The evolution of different tribes obviously has not proceeded at the same pace. So I take almost an illegal attitude to the racial problem in this country. And have been criticized severely for it. I would think that by now, you know, the integration movement started in the early 60s, late 50s. Well, that was 60, 70 years ago. I had thought by now that they would have acclimated entirely to our advanced culture. They have not. Why? Only a few have. I will note the difference between men and women. The black women, who now go to college in great numbers, and who commit crimes at a much lower rate than black males, I have no criticism, except the fact that they allow themselves to bear children without fathers to take care of them. I think they allow themselves to be used by black men. But black males themselves, particularly in the age bracket, between, say, 15 and 30, that one group creates problems far beyond their numbers. And I think it's a very worrisome problem for the United States. Imagine if this country were 100% Caucasian. Or imagine it was, say, 90% Caucasian, like it used to be in 1950. Imagine it was 90% Caucasian and, say, 5% Japanese and, say, 5% Vietnamese. Our cultural level would be miles ahead of where it is. We have paid a heavy penalty for slavery. The greatest mistake ever made was kidnapping millions of black people from Western Africa and bringing them here. It has caused us a civil war. It has caused us years of segregation and unequal justice. it has been a disaster for this country. Europe doesn't have that problem to the same extent. They are allowing immigrants, but their immigrants mostly are Arabs who have a problem of bringing with them a different religion. That's a different kind of problem. But everybody knows that the Arabs are civilizable, and they have had civilizations in the past, great civilizations. The civilization of Baghdad was a high culture. Black people. I mean, what is the very best that has ever been done by black people? Not very much.
Right. So, what do you consider to be the ideal solution for the decline of whites racially in America and Europe?
Well, it's two different problems. In America, I believe in a restoration of segregation. I believe the races should separate. And I believe, this will get me in real trouble, but I believe that black people could be rewarded, and many would accept the reward, to be sterilized. You know, if you were to pay $10,000 for a typical black man, he might very well be willing to be sterilized.
And he might come back the next year and want to do it again.
Right. Well, we'd be permanently sterilized.
I'm just joking.
Yeah, right. Or if that doesn't work, I mean, these ideas, you know, could never take place in our political climate, particularly our politicians who are in love with the black demographic.
Right.
But segregation of type, maybe even a separation, a geographic separation of some kind, so that the two races would intermix only very infrequently. Yeah. As for Europe, I don't understand Europeans. You know, they don't need it. They are not saddled with the former slave population to whom they are obligated.
Right.
We have certain obligations, because indeed we did bring these people over unwillingly.
Yeah.
But in Europe, they are allowed in for God knows what reason. I mean, Europe's not underpopulated. Why do they need why do they need millions of Muslims to come into their countries? Those countries would not allow millions of Europeans to come into their country.
Well, in the past, that was called colonialism.
Yeah,
it was rebuffed.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, Europe, a country like the Netherlands, I think the Netherlands is the most densely populated country in the world, maybe. They don't need immigration.
They don't need immigration.
Yeah.
It's different. I mean, black people in this country are mostly Christians, so there's no great religious conflict. But in Europe, the Muslim population has a different mindset. They have a different psychology. They really genuinely believe they have a duty to Islamize the world.
Yeah.
And they are contemptuous of Christianity and would like to replace it if they can. And in parts of France, they already have. There are already neighborhoods where Sharia law prevails. Incredible the French would allow something like that to happen.
Right. So, the Node really is not that unrealistic in a way, because on the one hand, it's postulating a future where demographic displacement and political correctness in America have really driven whites to being a beleaguered race.
Yes.
And then on the other hand, you have your vision of how that might be turned around, how the world might be turned around. And that's a theme that you take up in your book, Reuben, as well, that Washington Summit Publishers put out. And it's also in the unpublished book that I read, the Bed Pyramid.
Yes.
So would you like to talk a bit about how you envision whites might organize themselves to politically pull ourselves out of this this death spiral that we're in demographically and culturally?
Well, I think it's possible, but I think it's improbable. You know,
right.
When I look into the future, I really don't believe this problem is going to be solved. I believe that the populations are going to become so scrambled and heterogeneous that we're going to have to learn to live with a mixed race, a population that is entirely mixed race. You know, it's like I once had a German Shepherd dog. My neighbor once had a Boxer dog. and each was a remarkable creature. I mean, each had its peculiarities, had its racial peculiarities.
Right.
The boxer is an odd animal, and he, as long as he remains a boxer, he's going to exemplify his certain pattern of virtues and vices. Same thing for the German Shepherd. But when they breed, all that's lost. All that's lost. You know, when you know, if you were to take a 7-foot-tall black basketball player and have him marry a short white woman, the result's not going to be extraordinary in any way. I mean, he's not going to be very tall, he's not going to be very short. So the peculiarities get lost. Unique features get lost when different species interbreed. And I think that white people, my argument for white people is, we know that they can create civilizations because they've done it in the past.
Right.
And that the civilization called Western civilization has contributed more to the world than all other races put together. That's because of certain peculiarities that white people possess. If they become totally intermixed, if we end up with one global race, one wall-to-wall race, those peculiarities are going to disappear. I mean, could the Chinese have written Wagner's operas? Could an Arab, you know, have written Shakespeare's? I mean, white people have certain values, certain virtues, certain gifts. It should be preserved. I mean, so do other races. I don't mean to say that other races don't have any virtue. They have their own. I mean, the Chinese, you know, or adept people can do all sorts of things that we could not do. If the Chinese were to come to America when America was in the 18th century, the Chinese would not have created anything like what we have turned out to be in this country. It might have been better, but it wouldn't be the same. So what people who care about diversity, like I do, you know, ought to wish to keep the races apart. Instead, they believe in diversity, and they also believe in homogenization, which is, when you think about it, an extraordinary irony.
It's a simple self-contradiction.
Yes.
Yeah. We believe in diversity, so we're going to mix everything up until it's all the same.
Well, I realize, you know, these thoughts of mine are unpopular, can get me into big trouble. And the big publishers wouldn't touch me with 20-foot poles. And the last big publisher I had was Overlook. And that's not a huge publisher, but they publish about 100 books a year.
Mm-hmm.
And they published me with reluctance. And then the book, of course, didn't sell very well, so they didn't push it at all. They didn't promote it whatsoever. So I don't even try to get published by major publishers. It's a waste of time.
Right. We skipped over a couple of your books, actually. We skipped over The Fields of Asphodel and The Sweet-Scented Manuscript.
Morning Crafts.
Yeah, we'll get to Morning Crafts, too. Yeah. Do you want to talk about, before we go back to your more recent politically charged books, tell us a little bit about Fields of Asphodel and The Sweet-Scented Manuscript.
The Sweet-Scented Manuscript is almost pure autobiography. It's a love story. It's a story of my wife and myself, and how we met, and fought, and argued, and came together, and got married when we were 18 years old, and started out in abject poverty, and worked each other through college. She worked me through, I worked her through. And when I became a writer, never has there ever been a writer who's gotten better assistance, more support than I have. I mean, she would do anything to make it possible for me to write. She worked full-time so that I could stay home and write. For years and years, she did this. And anything I have ever needed to write, she has supplied. She was the one that introduced me to computers because she thought it would be helpful to me as a writer. I wanted nothing to do with it. She had virtually forced me to buy a computer. And she knew what I needed better than I needed. So she's really my joint author. I mean, no other wife could have done what she has done. She's spent time on the cross to make it possible for me to write. The sweet thing in many scripts about how we came together at this college, how we both got expelled, how the man that expelled me told me that I would never amount to anything, that I condemned myself, and that by getting kicked out of school, I ruined my future. Well, I was determined to show that he was wrong. Of course, he's been dead now many years, so I haven't shown him anything.
Right. But, well, you showed the rest of the world.
Yeah. And Fields of Acidale. I'm trying to remember what that's all about. I had been reading a religious text, and I decided since I had pretty well covered Lee's life on Earth, I decided I needed to cover his post-mortem life. Mm-hmm. What happened to him after he died? What punishments did he qualify himself for in the next world? So this is a long march through the afterworld. And the torments that he sees being inflicted upon others, torments that he himself is subjected to. Meanwhile, he's searching for his dead wife in the afterworld. And there's some comical parts to it. It's not that I take the afterworld seriously, but I thought it made a good setting for a novel.
Right.
A postmortem novel. That's what that's all about. And it's a funny thing about that book. I don't remember it very well. I don't remember writing it, you know. And that's becoming true of all my books. I have trouble remembering what mood was I in when I wrote this thing. Who wrote this goddamn thing, you know?
Did I write this thing?
Yeah.
I have experiences, and so far they're generally good, where I'll go back and read something I wrote years ago and think, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
Did I know this at the time? I don't remember knowing this now. What was going on then?
So you notice that when you read a section and you don't like it, not necessarily your own work, but somebody else's work, you don't like it, then the next day you try it again, you do like it.
Yeah.
In 24 hours, your whole mood can change, your whole receptivity to literature can change. At least with me, it does. Mm-hmm.
There's some works, too, that I just wasn't mature enough to appreciate when I first encountered them, and I sort of grew into them.
Yes.
The books didn't change, I changed, and suddenly I could go back to it, and it made sense.
Yes.
It made sense. It was no longer hard to understand.
Yeah, that's true for the early English books, like Fielding or, you know, Clarissa, the early English novels, you know, seem very boring when you're young.
Oh, yeah. Richardson. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but now I should return to that. I think I would probably get more out of it.
The prose is a hell of a lot better than what's being done today. You know, I mean, I just cannot abide the popular best-selling prose today. Sounds just like conversation, you know. It's like casual, lazy conversation. There's no effort to have cadence, but cadence in prose. There's no effort to make long with big sentences. At least when you pick up a bestseller in a bookstore.
Oh, yeah, it's all sawdust. It's just literary sawdust. I was doing reviews of these Twilight movies because they were very popular, and I saw the first one, and I thought, there's actually something rather subversive about this. And I had heard that the books were phenomenally popular, so I picked the books up. And I was astounded at how pedestrian and padded the writing was.
Yeah.
And the gaucheries, the mistakes that had gotten into print.
Yeah.
And this was published by a major publishing house.
Oh, yeah, they love that stuff.
Are they just illiterates there? Do they not have any editors? Do they not have any taste? Why, they know how to blog it to the public. And I hate to say something that will seem heretical to most people, but I picked up the first Harry Potter novel that people like, and I just found it so pedestrian, I set it down. It couldn't maintain my interest in literature. And I know many people, including many very serious people, who just love those books. I just can't take it seriously. Whereas children's literature written 3 or 4 or 5 generations ago, it's superior in both in terms of its imagination, but also in terms of the quality of the writing.
Yes.
It's written in ways that adults can appreciate.
Winnie the Pooh, what can be better than Winnie the Pooh?
Yeah. the Oz books, which I loved when I was a kid. Yes. I was home, and they were still sitting on my bookshelf in my bedroom at home, and I took one down and I started reading it, and I thought, my goodness, this really is engaging just as literature.
Yes.
Whereas you just don't get quality literature written for young people today. It just doesn't happen.
I know, that's the way I feel about my writing.
So, in the Node, the titular entity, the Node, is part of a network.
That's right.
Right? And the network is a resistance network to the dispossession of white people.
Exactly.
How did this idea come to you? And share some of your thoughts about it, and tell us, do you think maybe this is applicable? Do you think some people out there in the white nationalist world might read this novel with profit and might seek to emulate certain aspects of it?
Well, I noticed the way that the Nazi Party originated and the Bolshevik Party, how they originated. They originated in little groups of like-minded intellectuals.
Right.
And then somehow, through some magic, expanded to cover the whole country, or in the case of Marxism, the whole continent. Yet it started small with a group of brilliant people. So, if you could get a group of people who are able to think originally and could link up with like-minded people 1,000 miles away, who knows what might happen? They might be able to despite persuasion. But, imagine Thomas Jefferson, or John Locke. These were just little individuals standing out by themselves. Imagine like David Hume, their ideas of it, like Karl Marx.
Right.
They conquered whole continents just in little groups, starting as little groups. Everything that we now believe started in the mind of someone. Today they're considered platitudes. They're considered, without indisputable ideas, majority rules. Well, somebody had to invent that, the idea of free speech. Where did that come from? We take it for granted. But it didn't used to be taken for granted. So all movements start with individuals or small groups. Now, just how in the world they gain force, how in the world they gain, they're able to persuade large numbers of people, it's like a sort of magic. Who would have ever guessed that the National Socialist Party, with 7 members to begin with, could take over a whole continent? Yet it happens. It happens, through the battle of ideas. And in the case of the National Socialists, they were aided by a depression, which
right.
made everybody have to reconsider everything. So ideas consider her abhorrent in 1925, suddenly became attractive by 1935. The people hadn't changed, it's just the conditions had brought these ideas to the fore and supported those ideas. Or, the Bolsheviks came to power during the First World War when the country was upside down and starving. Those ideas were not a gain force when the Tsar was in full power. But suddenly they become solutions. They seem to be solutions. And they gain, not necessarily majority, but they gain people who know how, activistic people. Small group of activistic people can take over a whole country. When the Bolsheviks took over Russia, there were only 25,000 Bolsheviks. They took over a country of 200 million. So, we do not know about it. We know one thing, and that is our current situation will not last forever. Nothing ever does. No political theory is permanent. So the question is, when will it change and how will it change? We've tried democracy. We've tried this exaggerated form of democracy that we now suffer under. Cannot get much more democratic without becoming a form of communism. Everybody's equal in this country, although everybody knows people are not equal. We're living in a lie, starting with Jefferson's dictum that all people are created. People are not created. Yet it's a convenient lie, and it's been successful so far. But as life gets more complicated, technology gets more complicated, equality is not going to be able to solve our problems. We're going to be ruled, governed eventually by no by the kind of people Plato suggested in the Republic. People who know something. People who actually know something. Most Americans know nothing. Most Americans, you know, their cultural levels no higher than primetime television. So that's not going to last forever. And the idea that all races can come together and homogenize and love each other and hold hands and sing songs together, that's not going to work. Multiculturalism never works. It didn't work in Yugoslavia, it didn't work in the Soviet Empire, it didn't even work in the Babylonian Empire. It's a failed theory. And only Americans are gullible enough to think that they can make it work. If you have a society that's, say, 60% Caucasian and, say 30% Hispanic and 20% black, you know, and 10%, that's not going to work. It's because people don't feel comfortable with each other. You never feel like you're at home.
Right.
You never feel like you're where you should be. You might survive. Like when I go to New York, I survive. That's all it is.
You can't flourish.
You can't flourish. You can't be yourself. You're always walking on eggshells lest you offend someone. And I think that society will eventually find that unendurable. I think it will split. Certainly split ideologically, maybe even split geographically. It would not greatly shock me that 100 years from now, if we had another secession. I have friends in the South that ready to secede right now. Anxious to secede. A fighting for it.
Right. So are you a member of the League of the South? Talk to me a little bit about your Southern identity and your politics and how these things fuse together and how they influence your outlook on the present day.
Well, when I was growing up in the South, I grew up in a small town, northeast Alabama. And I would get up in the morning, have a breakfast, go outside immediately because the weather was usually very nice. I might walk a block, get involved in a baseball game, or I might go out to the golf course and hunt for lost golf balls, or I might go to school, sitting shoulder to shoulder with people who were of my same race and had my same attitudes. I might flirt with girls who understood me and whom I understood. I might go on vacation to Florida and catch fish shoulder to shoulder with people who went there for the same purpose. I was home.
Right.
It was a home. And it was a community. Now, it is true that the black community was different, segregated. They had their own community. And their community was less prosperous, to be sure, than my community. But this will outrage some people, but they surely seemed to be a lot happier then than they are now. There weren't millions of them in penitentiaries. There weren't millions of them who were dope addicts. They weren't breeding children they couldn't take care of. They had lowly jobs. They were housekeepers. And on the golf course, they were caddies. I mean, I would not want to change places.
Right.
And I'm not saying they were socially equal, but I'm saying that they were at home.
Right.
They were at home, and I was at home, and we waved to each other across the boundary. And we deeply worked with them. We dealt with them. But there's never any question of overlap. That was forbidden.
Right.
Impossible. And it worked. Segregation worked. Worked beautifully. You know, liberals today boast about integration. But I think integration's been a disaster. I mean, in integration today, where black people have been thrown into direct economic competition with white people, a competition they cannot win. So they are bitter. They're bitter because they're trying to do what white people do and can't. And some can. I mean, 10% of black people are highly intelligent, no doubt about it. Some 10% or 15% can succeed. They do well. They're the ones you see on television. They're the ones you see broadcasting the news, you know. Well, they're like the golf player, Tiger, whatever his name, Tiger Woods. Well-spoken, you know, or they're like Obama, or like the General Powell. Black people can do that. They're capable of that. But only a few are.
Yeah, there's just not enough.
That's right.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
And it's really the average rather than the exception that determines the overall quality of
precisely
a civilization and how they interact with us.
That's right. Sure. You know, in Australia, there is a minority group, I forget, the Aborigines, have an average IQ of 62. That's the average IQ of 62. The government builds houses for them, but they prefer to sleep outside, even in the winter. I mean, they're so primitive, but they're the wards of the government.
Yeah. When the whites arrived in Australia, the Aborigines did not know the facts of life. They did not know that there is a causal connection between sex and reproduction.
Yeah.
That had to be explained to them.
Yeah.
And apparently, at some point in their past, they had domesticated the dog, but the dogs wouldn't have anything to do with them at the time that the whites arrived. They were all wild. So there had been a degeneration of their low level of culture had degenerated even further, and the Aboriginal people of Tasmania actually didn't have the power to create fire. The Australians could make fire, but the Tasmanians couldn't. They'd have to wait until a lightning strike happened and it started a forest fire, and then they realized that fire had utility, they'd keep it. But if it went out, they had no way of replicating it.
Yeah.
So,
I'm going to talk tonight about the Maori Aborigines of New Zealand, who are not quite so unintelligent as the Australian Aborigines, but are they're a ward of the government.
Yeah.
And the British, being British, took a kindly attitude toward them, you know, and have allowed them to have jobs and provided housing for them.
Yeah.
But it's a touch-and-go situation. But, you know, the civil rights movement gave great encouragement to black people. And the election of Obama gave encouragement. They said, okay, now we're equal. Okay, now we have made it. You know, we're going to be just like, we're going to have 20-room houses. We're going to have, you know, $40,000 automobiles just like everybody else. And it's not happening, of course. And it cannot happen. And so they become more and more enraged that they cannot succeed to a middle class quality of life. So they turn to criminality out of bitterness, disappointment. And I see no solution to that. The only solution I see, this is supposed to be a joke, is if you could bring all the Caucasians together, and by using laser beams, you could vaporize about 1 cubic inch of cortex, then we would all be equal.
Right. Yeah. Well, a friend of mine has suggested that the only thing that we need to do is give them 20,000 years of additional evolution in a cold climate, then we'll achieve equality.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's not doable within our lifetimes, and we have to stop predicating our whole political system on an impossibility.
Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about Reuben, which Washington Summit Publishers brought out. Reuben is very similar in some ways in its assumptions to the Node.
Yes.
And it is, again, it's a description of a dystopian America and of a particular figure, the titular character, who sets things right. It's not, and he is part of a network, he's part of an organization, and he combines intelligence with a certain amount of brutality and becomes sort of a legislator behind the scenes for a revived America. So,
I wanted to write a novel about a person who's perfect. A person high, very high intelligence. A person of great physical ability. A person who's a model of the model physique. A person with the willpower beyond all willpowers. You know, a person that can never exist, of course, but the ideal human being. And I wanted him to be trained by my usual protagonist, Lee, and his wife, to be trained to the highest possible degree of perfection, and then to turn him loose upon the world to see what he could accomplish.
Right.
And he accomplishes enormous things. He turns the world upside down. And by the time he's old and finished, we have a civilized country. We have a hierarchical country. We have a scientific, technologically advanced country. We have a cultural. We have the greatest culture since the Greeks. That was the idea. What if we had a perfect human being? He'd be a monster in some way.
Yeah, and he is sort of monster.
He is a monster. A perfect person would be a monster. Yeah. A monster of virtue, a monster of strength, and a monster of intolerance.
Yeah.
Because to excellence today is intolerance.
Right.
And he is very intolerant. He smashes everything that doesn't measure up. And I really enjoyed it.
What is the meaning of his withered leg?
Well, it's all great men have a defect.
Right.
You know, like Napoleon was 5 feet tall. You know? Mm-hmm. Stalin had a withered arm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everybody, even a perfect person, has to have a defect. And he has to overcome something. You have to overcome to become excellent. And it's necessary to have a weakness that you've defeated. You have to have defeated some internal personal defect to become great. You know, if he were absolutely physically perfect, you know, he would not have developed the willpower that he has developed. And I wanted to make him vulnerable, like Achilles' heel.
Right.
So he has this vulnerability, so he could easily be hurt. You know, somebody could smash his leg and he'd be crippled. Or
right.
So I wanted to make him vulnerable, but great at the same time.
Right. Our interview team has been joined by my dog, so I'm going to take his collar and leash off and put him in stealth mode. So he's actually been a guest at many of my interviews, but always with the jingling things off. So now the dog is in stealth mode, so we can continue. I'm sorry for the interruption. Let's talk about two other books of yours now. Yeah. Let's talk about Morning Crafts. And I want to relate it a bit to an unpublished book, The Bent Pyramid, because there are some similarities. One thing that connects the two is there is a resistance movement, if you will, to modernity that values liberal education tremendously. And that is something in your novels that really speaks to me, because even when I was 16 years old, I, on the one hand, was extremely attached to civilization, world civilization, but Western civilization especially, because it was mine. And I also had the sense that it was all in danger. And years later, when I was in college, I think it was my second year of college, I read Alistair MacIntyre's book, After Virtue. And at the end, he talks about how, you know, civilization is threatened by barbarism, and we need something like the Benedictines to preserve knowledge through the Dark Ages. And I see that concern in your work as well.
Yeah.
A lot of your protagonists hoard books and try and pass on knowledge.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. That's a very important theme that I discern in your writing.
Well, you know, Toynbee claims that every civilization is threatened internally and externally. Internal barbarians and external barbarians. And he mentioned Greece, for example, which was always under threat by the Persians, by other barbarous people. And internally by subversives and by ignorance. But every society, no matter where, has these twin threats. Sometimes they're greater than they are at other times, sometimes lesser. But that the barbarians are always at the gates. Every civilization is delicate. Like when the barbarians went into Rome, they smashed every statue inside. You know, they were affronted by our civilization because they didn't have it.
Right.
So they hate examples of excellence because it was beyond them. The only thing they could think to do would be to destroy it. And I think that's true today. I mean, we have millions of people in this country. You can't imagine why we have libraries. You know, that would be easy to burn them down. Why shouldn't they be burned down? Why do we have statuary? You know, why do people go to operas? Operas is for snobs. No, we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those people are college students. I mean, those people are the very people that ought to be learning to appreciate them. I mean, the Philistinism that you find in the modern college is appalling. I remember I read one time about some fellow who was walking across the campus of Yale University, and he could hear music coming from the dormitories. And the music was Shostakovich or Ravel or something. He says, now, when he goes across the college campus, he hears 2 cent up yours or, you know, or 5 cent rap, you know.
Right.
Junk.
Yeah.
From Ivy League students. You know, their cultural taste is ground zero. They don't seem to have learned anything. I mean, they've learned how to make a living. They've learned law. They've learned medicine. But they haven't learned to care about literature or history. There's this internal bubbling up of ignorance that you see on television particularly, or that you see in presidential debates, or you see on the newscast, where the big issues are never touched. You know, it's such a natural sort of decline, I think, that Rome must have gone through. But that is very worrisome. And
well, just basically just talk about your feelings about the
dangers to
civilization and what are the things that we need to do to preserve it.
Well, what we need to do is to get rid of the notion of equality. Quit trying to educate the uneducable. Think of the billions that we spend on people that don't want education, and if they had it, wouldn't use it, don't want it, can't avail themselves of it. Billions of dollars spent on putting people through college, you have no business going to college. We need hierarchy. We need intellectual hierarchy in this country. The idea that everybody gets the same amount of vote, gets one vote.
Right.
There's some people who just vote by flipping the coin. Why should they get a vote? The idea that people are equally capable of making political judgments is a lie. They're not equally capable. So the first, I think that equality, the notion of universal law of equality, is destroying Western culture. You know, at one time, women couldn't vote, and then one time, black people couldn't vote. I'm not saying those were utopian times, those were frontier periods of time. Those were 19th century periods of time. So even the white males, you know, were not as wise as we would want them to be. But at least there was the idea that not everybody's equally qualified. It's the idea that everybody is equally qualified to make decisions for the community that is killing us.
Right.
And so that's my greatest complaint about postmodernity.
Yeah, you can't equalize up. You end up equalizing down.
Right. And there's no bottom.
Yeah.
You can continue to go down to the very savagery.
Well, we're seeing that in Iraq today, aren't we?
Oh, yeah.
These people smashing statues.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
So equality means mediocrity. By definition, equality is mediocrity. In a society that makes that its prime goal, as we have done, we've made equality our theme song. It means that we can never rise to the level of Greece or Florence. It wouldn't be permitted.
Right. So what do you think the greatest periods in Western civilization were?
Well, of course, I think the 5th century Athens was the greatest. But I think, we don't know much about Minoan civilization, but I would not be surprised if Crete had a very high civilization before the Mycenaeans destroyed it. That might have been. I'm not sure about that. That might have been a very great civilization.
Well, certainly the material culture that survived is astonishing.
Yes.
And refined.
Yes.
And beautiful.
Absolutely.
You know, this is sort of a digression maybe since we're talking about you, but I have a theory that I think is worthwhile. It's a hypothesis. We know that the Minoans basically gave their visual and material culture to the Mycenaeans. The Mycenaeans adopted their art style a great deal. We know that they took a great deal from them materially. We can see that comparing the styles of things and technology and so forth. We also know now that the Pylos tablets have been deciphered. that the Mycenaeans worshipped the same pantheon that the later Greeks worshipped. And there's an interesting fact about the Greek gods. The names of the Greek gods are all non-Indo-European except for Zeus, which just means Heavenly Father, right? The other gods' names are non-Indo-European. And my hypothesis is simply this, that the Mycenaeans not only adopted elements of the material culture, the Minoans, they adopted their spiritual culture as well. They adopted their religion and mythology. And if that's the case, then we know what Mycenaean culture was, because that's what we call Greek mythology. That's what we call Greek civilization. And the not only were the material elements and elements of style and technology taken over, but its spiritual elements, the core myths. And so the spiritual culture of the Minoans has survived.
Yes.
And it's what we call ancient Greece.
Basically. I think the Greek synthetic religion borrowed not just from the Minoans, but also from Phoenicia.
Yeah.
And had heavy influence from Asia Minor.
Yeah.
The Hittites even, maybe.
Yeah.
But the Greeks had, you know, agglomerating the gods.
Yeah.
You know, what do you call it, seizing them, you know, taking them up. No matter where they went, yeah. They thought that the local gods were their gods.
Yeah.
The same as their gods.
Yeah.
They could go to Egypt, and they thought, it's, you know, that the Egyptian gods were just another name for their gods.
Yeah. They were all translatable in some sense, yeah. Because there was all some sense that there was a unity of religion, a deep unity. So, what's next for you in terms of publishing?
In terms of publishing?
Yeah, yeah.
Not in terms of publishing, but not necessarily in terms of writing. My next hope is that John Morgan will fulfill his promise and publish all my unpublished books.
How many unpublished books do you have?
Well, I've written 20 altogether, and I've published 7. So I have 13 books to be published. If he does, of course, he has the right to reject them. All he has is first refusal.
Right.
If he doesn't like a book of mine, then suddenly I'm free to submit it elsewhere.
Right.
If he does like it, then he gets the right to publish it. And he was supposed to publish 2 last year, but he got embroiled in the Budapest problems.
Right.
And the Budapest don't try to kick him out of Hungary.
Yeah.
But he's still there. And so he didn't publish anything of mine last year. Last book he published of mine was Morning Press.
Right.
And so he's promised to publish 4 books this year to make up for last 4 books of mine.
Well, we have a lot of good Tito Perdue to look forward to in the near future, though. That's great.
That's a great publisher, by the way. I love it.
Arctos, yeah.
It operates,
yeah. Yeah. Well, are you writing new material?
No. I wrote a book that I finished about a month ago called The We Be Dead. Yet, what is the title? Though We Be Dead Yet What?
Well, I thought that was the end.
No, it's Though We Be Dead Yet Our Day Shall Come. Though We Be Dead Yet Our Day Shall Come. And it's about a high school, it's about a reunion of a high school class.
Ah.
So the first half of the book is about a bunch of kids I knew in 1950. And the second half of the book is what has become of them now in 2015. So I can describe how they declined or improved or became odd, you know.
Uh-huh.
So it's a clash between the two periods. And of course, most of them are my age. Of course, these are 70-year-old people, 75-year-old people. And many of them have deteriorated. Some have become criminals. Others are divorced. Others, you know, are despondent or ill. And it was just a character study of the 6 or 7 people that I well knew when I was 12 years old.
Oh, interesting.
And it's the funniest of my books. I mean, this time I really tried to be humorous. You know.
Uh-huh.
Did you find it funny, Jane?
I haven't seen
it. Oh, that's right. Anyway, it was...
So you are writing. So the answer was yes, you are continuing to write.
I guess so. I haven't written in a month or so.
Oh, well, I mean, not in a month. Well, yes. we'll give you another month and you'll be writing again.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Although I can tell that my and grey cells are disappearing. I'm not as quick as I was. I wrote the Big Pyramid in a month. You know.
Uh-huh.
And the one before that, Philip, one of my favorite books. I wrote in a month. I was writing, you know, 5-6 books a year. But,
wow.
But not now. Not now. Today it's more of a struggle.
So I think this is a good time to sort of wrap things up. We've gone almost another hour.
Yeah.
So let me just ask you to leave us with your thoughts for people who are thinking of becoming writers. Do you have advice for aspiring writers out there?
My advice is if you want to write commercial fiction and make money, go ahead. You might make a lot of money. Go ahead and try it. If that's your aspiration, pursue it. But if you're interested in literary fiction, if you're trying to write something that's really a piece of art, don't do it. Forget it. It's too late. It won't be published. If it is published, it won't be read. So just don't bother.
Well, I hope the people don't listen to that bit of advice. I hope they at least try, because there are publishers out there now. I mean, you went through a little dry spell in terms of the mainstream, but then Nine Banded Books.
Yes.
Published you, and then Arctos published you, and Radix, Washington Summit Publishers. So I'm kind of hoping that there will be a little renaissance of serious literature, at least amongst people in the so-called alternative right who appreciate literature and, you know, realize that some good writing cannot be run through the politically correct sausage machine.
Yeah.
And so if you want to write really good literary, politically correct fiction, well, don't bother. That's my advice. But if you're a nonconformist, a contrarian, and you want to write good literary fiction, there are publishers out there now emerging. So yeah.
Well, but I mean, it is such a disappointing thing. I mean, I never expected sell large numbers of copies.
Right.
But I thought that it might catch fire in some way, you know, that it'd be that maybe 1,000 people would care for it. But I don't have anything like 1,000 readers, you know. And so if you want influence, you know, secretly, I suppose, I did want some influence. I didn't get it, you know, I didn't have it. If I had been working those years, I'd be a multi-millionaire.
Right.
But I didn't work. She did all the work. And so, you know, we live in a, you know, lower middle class. So it's a sacrifice you have to make if you want to write literary fiction. And I don't know. Sometimes I feel like it was worth it. Sometimes I don't. Anyway, it's too late now to worry about it. So, you know, I mean, it's something I feel like I had to do.
Right.
If I'd gotten old without having done that, I would consider myself a failure, you know, that I didn't fail myself.
Right.
So I didn't fail myself, but I can go through life fond of myself without my millions.
Right. Well, one of the things that was moving to me about the new austerities was that there's a shift in there between standards of success. Because on the one hand, the main figure is confessing failure by the standards of the world.
Yeah.
He went off to New York City, and he left his homestead, and he ended up retreating. He ended up coming back.
Yeah.
But there's a revision of your standards. But on one hand, he was a loser by the standards of the world.
Yeah.
But he was realizing at the same time that the standards of the world are not all that valid.
No.
That you do, the real standard has got to be yourself, in a way.
Yeah.
But not just yourself as you are now, you know, whatever state of fallenness or lack of risenness, which is pretty clumsy phrase, but whatever level of immaturity you are at, but you're yourself as you can be. You know,
I feel that
self-actualization is the standard.
Yes.
Do you feel like you've lived an actualized life in terms of your own standards and your own talents?
I do. I mean, There was a long period where I thought that I would never do anything that was important to me, that I would just go to work, bring home my paycheck, and that's life. But I broke with that, you know. I did what I really wanted to do. And even if I never sold a single copy, I can think, you know, my God, I did it, you know. I wrote those thousands of pages. I did it. I didn't ask for a reward, didn't get a reward, and I'm not sure if anybody cares. But I did it. That's what I wanted to do. I had to do that. And I think most writers today, they're looking at the reward.
Right.
They want to be bestsellers. They want to be good-looking, thin. They want to be slim and to have many billions of dollars and to marry a movie actor. You know? That was never what I wanted, you know.
Right.
I mean, I have contempt for people like that, really. And I feel like I have a right to be contemptuous. I've earned the right to be contemptuous. Opportunists, mainstream opportunists, you know. I look for the utter contempt.
Yeah, what does it profit you to gain the whole world?
Lose your own soul.
Exactly. Well, Tito Perdue, Judy, thank you so much. This has been a really, really good conversation, and I hope it's just the beginning of future ones.
Well, at my age, there's not a whole lot of future left. Maybe I can make good use of it.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. Appreciate your interest.